Welcome to the Retzel Health Law Hotspot. Health Law Hotspot is a podcast for physicians and health professionals that covers the legal issues and trends that affect the healthcare industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Health Law Hotspot. I'm Erica Adler, shareholder at Retzel and Andrus, and the Health Law Group Practice Leader. Today, I'm joined by one of my colleagues, Adam Hirsch, who's part of our litigation and employment law group, and someone I work with very frequently when it comes to physician, dental, and other professionals in dealing with their non-competes, both from an employer, employee, as well as independent contractor side. So today, what we're really going to be talking about is what do non-competes really mean for employers, employees, and independent contractors? What do they really need to know and understand about them? Because I think there's actually a lot of misunderstanding about how to properly write one, how enforceable they are, and when to use them or not use them. So thanks for joining me today, Adam, and I'm excited to talk about this topic.
Thanks, Erica. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation as well.
Well, why don't we start by just having you kind of give us the general premise of non-competes and related provisions from your perspective and how we use them in our contracts with healthcare professionals, both on the practice and the provider side. And one of the things I'll start off by saying is that there seems to be a huge, false impression that people don't need to worry about non-competes on the provider side, that they're not enforceable anyways. And I don't think that's true at all. And so I definitely want to hear from you about what you think is going on right now with non-competes.
Sure. And let me take the second part first, because I do think it's important. And if people take nothing else from this conversation, then I would hope they would take the idea that you cannot jump to a conclusion. You cannot make a general statement or a generality, either as a in the provider context, as a private practice employer, as an employee or independent contractor, in any of those contexts. Non-competes are fact-intensive inquiries for lawyers and for courts. The law varies state by state. So I happen to practice in Illinois, and Illinois has a very well-defined body of law on non-competes for people across the state line. In Indiana, it may be different on some salient point, and around the country, more different still. So jumping to conclusion, either that they are all enforceable or they are all unenforceable is I would say, not a wise step to take. And that's why we are here. And that's why, you know, the advice is always to consult an attorney knowledgeable in your state about the law. And so what's going on, and I guess I would just sort of define some terms off the top. So and these provisions tend to show up in employment contracts, right? It's not something that exists in a statute that would apply to everybody or would exist out in the world without a contract. These are bargained for terms. They are very common, but you do have to sign a contract to bind yourself to them. So the first bit of advice always, and it seems simple, but you've got to say it, is read what you sign. And so non-competes, that term means a contractual restriction on performing some competing employment in competition with your former employer. So these terms tend to apply after you have separated from your employer or practice or provider or what have you. So non-competition focuses on what are you doing? A non-solicitation provision focuses on your contact with your former patients, the patient list at your former practice, and perhaps former employees. Maybe you had an indispensable office manager that you just have to try and bring with you, and a non-solicitation provision might prevent you from talking to that person and bringing them with. And then the other bucket, I would say there are more, but the three big ones would be non-competition, non-solicitation, and then preservation or return of confidential information, which could be things as simple as a patient list, if it's a more high-end specialized practice, or it could be processes, or it could be procedures. I mean, you can't list everything, but those are the three sort of terms you should look for in a contract: non-competition, non-solicitation, and prohibition on use of confidential information.
Right. So, you know, and I look at contracts all over the country, and I think, you know, state to state, they all kind of generally look very similar. In some states like California, you're not necessarily going to see one in an employment agreement. In other states, they have very specific statutes that tell you kind of what the non-compete can say, how long it can be, how big it can be, et cetera. So, but generally without those, you know, specifics, we really are looking at a non-compete that says you cannot do something for some period of time. If we just look at that first component, a lot of times it might be start, manage, or work for some competing organization within a certain radius, right? And I've seen, like, with a small practice in a busy city like Chicago, you know, a mile might be quite significant. And then for a hospital system, I've seen non-competes that are huge. It could be 50 miles. And a lot of times it has to do with the specialty, you know, or maybe it's the only children's hospital in the state or something like that. So I guess when you're looking at an agreement, before you start arguing, you know, between employer and employee, how do we define kind of what reasonable is, and can we really define it?
Well, I think that's the right question. And then that is ultimately mostly the crux of the case, if you are going to get it in the court and if it is going to be litigated, is what is reasonable. And I would, you know, sort of look at it. I think it's helpful, whether or not you're an employer or an employee, it's helpful to look at it from both sides, because it can give you some perspective as to what is reasonable and what makes sense. So I think you hit the attributes of a non-compete provision, which would be there's a geographical limit. And I've got one case now and where there may be a fight over whether the geographic limit is measured on a map with a ruler or by driving distance. And the new practice may be within the radius as the crow flies, but outside the radius if you use the Google Drive directions. And so these are the kinds of things, as you know, picky units they may be, that you need to think about. So there's geography, there is the verbiage used to limit your activities. And so you ticked off some verbs. I mean, a very common one is associate with, that you may not associate with another practice or hospital that does A, B, or C. That is obviously an incredibly broad term. There's some case law in Illinois that looks very askance at those types of terms. And the example the courts typically give says, well, if the non-compete says that you couldn't get hired as a janitor at the hospital, then it's not going to be enforceable. And so as an employer, I think what you want to ask yourself is, what do I really need to protect myself from? You know, what activities would be harmful to my business if an ex-employee engaged in them within so much distance of me? And if you can limit it, the more targeted it is as an employer, the more likely it is to be enforced, and the more likely it is you're going to be able to have a court respect it. And then on the other side, from the employee side, it's the flip side of the question. It's look at the mileage, and you know, maybe there's a neighborhood change, or if you're working, say, across the river, a suburb of St. Louis in Illinois, maybe 5 miles is okay, but 6 miles puts you in the middle of the Mississippi River. And you want to think about how these things are going to work, not just on paper, but in your real life. And so the questions, I think, should be approached from a basis of reality, not what was my last form, and also not what can I get away with? How big or mean can I make it that they will accept? Just because you have that kind of leverage doesn't mean necessarily it's going to be in your best interest to use it.
Right. Unfortunately, some large employers, hospitals in particular, are not going to negotiate their non-competes. And so one of the conversations I have with my clients very often is, can you live with this? Because the idea is, just as you said, maybe there's a case that would say the language is too broad, or maybe you think that it's not enforceable. But I don't think anybody wants to spend time and money fighting about it. So I always say, if you're going to sign the agreement, just plan to live with it. It's not worth fighting about. And if you think you can't live with it, then, you know, either fight it now or don't sign it. And that's really kind of the approach I give in the contract. But there's nobody I know who's gone through litigation on non-compete and say, well, that was really worth it. You know, at the end of the day, even if they win, it's years of their life and thousands of dollars, right? You know, so the question is it worth it? You know, one other component of the geography, and you and I have talked about this before, that I really want to touch on is, do we always need a geographical non-compete? And I really kind of want to have you speak to that in terms of, you know, whether we're talking about telemedicine or we're talking about an employer that has contracts with specific facilities where they wouldn't really care if someone was within 5 miles as long as they didn't go to that facility. You know, what are your thoughts on that kind of drafting?
I think it can be really valuable. And I think the one attribute that I didn't tick off a minute ago was duration, right? And so there's a very different feel to a 6-month non-compete versus a 6-year non-compete. So that's another variable here where if you're trying to decide whether or not to sign it, that, you know, if it's a year non-compete, the chances are litigation is going to take you past the expiration anyway.
Right.
So sort of, what are you doing? You're going to want to respect it so as to not generate damages. But to come back to your question on the geography, I think particularly, and it's particular for in healthcare with the way practices may be clustered around a hospital or way that different hospital chains are laid out geographically, certainly in Chicago, it may be enough for you to say, I don't care about the mileage, just don't practice here. Or I need you to, you know, it will hurt my business if this person comes, has privileges at this particular hospital. So long as they go, you know, a mile down the road, I'm going to be okay. And it's particularly true in Illinois, but I think it is true generally, the more precise you can make what you're prohibiting, the more likely it is to be enforced. And what the courts, I think, respond very favorably to is an employer who designs their non-competes with intention, with really, I need this, and here's why, and here's specifically. And the ones that feel like a pre-printed form, or that you recycled the last one you used for the last person that says 10 miles because it's a round number and it doesn't really have a business purpose, those are the ones that you're going to get in trouble on trying to enforce.
Right. So, and so just let's talk about business purpose here. Ed, I want to come back to the telemedicine in a second, but
yes,
you mentioned business purpose. You know, an employer who loses a contract, let's say, or an employer who has done something bad. Do they still have a business purpose that they can enforce at that point? Or are we suddenly home free in terms of, I can go, you know, down the street now because they didn't pay me on time, or they lost their contract, something like that?
I hate to give a lawyer answer, but I have to give a lawyer answer, which is it depends. And you'll see in a lot of contracts that the non-compete provisions may be linked to the termination for cause provision. And so there may be made, you know, it's wouldn't be unusual for a contract to say, all right, if you're not terminated for cause, if everybody just wants to move on, or if we're downsizing, then we're not going to enforce the non-compete. We're only going to enforce it if you're terminated with cause. So the first answer is see what the contract says. And if you're drafting a contract and you want to think about some of the instances where you really need a non-compete, you can link it or condition it in that way.
Right.
Or more generally, you know, it is dicey for an employee to choose to disregard a non-compete simply because their former employer did something bad. And, you know, if the practice loses privileges at a high, I mean, there's scenarios where you could see, you know, you would start to bring in some deeper legal doctrines like impossibility and frustration of purpose. And you can argue this, but it will be much cheaper and much more certain if you can try and hash it out on the front end in the contract, rather than trying to guess hypothetical scenarios, you know, 2 years down the road.
Right. I also find employers are more likely to enforce non-competes if the departure of the doctor is tied up with a motion. So they're angry, they don't like the way things went down, more likely to try and get the doctor as opposed to, you know, more of an amicable separation or an attempt to work things out. So I think, you know, that's directly related.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and I think lawyers remind people of this all the time that, you know, we're dealing with people. These disputes don't happen on paper. And there is going to be personal history and there is going to be emotion. And one practical thing, for example, that you might consider is, how is this outgoing doctor, how are you getting paid? If you're on a compensation formula that's got some runoff and you've got some billings that are going to be owed you, then the you know, let's say you need to wait till the end of a calendar year to figure out if you're going to get another chunk of money from your ex-employer. And let's say you leave in June and you've got 6 months. Well, a year-long non-compete sort of looks different then in that context. And then the employer, if they are vindictive or angry or if there's emotion, has a little bit more leverage, right? Because they've got one more check they've got to write and they're going to be, you know, scouring your Instagram to see where your practice pictures are and figuring out where your forwarding addresses are and doing the math on the map. So, you know, everything matters, of course, and it is a human interaction. And I think some of the advantages now, because non-competes are so ubiquitous, is that both employers and employees are starting to get some history on them. And I'm starting to see even individual clients who are on their third non-compete and sort of now have a sense of how this works. And I, you know, for better or for ill, maybe people play nicer because it's another piece of leverage from the employer. But yes, it is not going to play out only on paper. And that's something that everybody should keep in mind.
Right. And so just a couple of things. I want to go back to the telemedicine because, you know, telemedicine, especially during COVID, became a very big thing. And a lot of non-competes weren't written for telemedicine, right? In telemedicine, you don't really care where the guy has set up shop. You care where the patient is located. So you've really got to write those non-competes properly and maybe even amend your current non-compete to address that.
That last point is a great one because you definitely want to go back and see what verbs you used. And figure out whether, you know, how, what are you measuring from? We talked about the geography and I've got another case now where there's a question of, do we measure just from the main office or is it a little bubble around each affiliate office that is subject to the non-compete? So that's one part of it. The other part, particular to telehealth is, you know, that I think hits the non-solicitation language in a contract more than the non-compete language. Let's say, absent being smart and proactive and finding your lawyer and going back and amending your non-competes, let's say the non-compete isn't going to apply because your ex-employee is sitting at their lake house two states over. The question though is, how do they know what patients to contact? Did they take a patient list? Are they allowed to contact former patients? And those restrictions are more often in non-solicitation parts of contracts rather than non-competes. And with telehealth, I think those provisions, which were maybe the sidecar 10 years ago, maybe are now the main show because of the way telehealth is.
Right. Yeah, non-solicitation is really important. And I know you mentioned a couple of examples, but vendors, referral sources, and even doctors going to new practices, new hospitals, reaching out to their former colleagues or nurses, doctors that they work with. For dentists as well, this is non-solicitation is a big thing. And it's usually direct or indirect. So you can't do it, and then you can't ask your new employer to do it either, right?
That's right.
And, you know, there's obviously a lot of technical language on this type of topic, but I think people think, okay, I'm outside the area, but, you know, I'm just going to call up people. And, you know, it's with voicemail recordings and stuff like that. I mean, it's really easy to catch people in a solicitation situation. So you do need to be careful, right? That's one thing to work out.
It's all of that is right. And it's particularly true for practices where there's routine checkups, where somebody's coming in every 6 months or once a year. And where that can get tricky on both sides is like an oral restriction, right? So let's say you've given notice and you've got 90 days left at the practice, and people are coming in, and then they say, all right, we need to see you in 6 months, and you know you're not going to be there in 6 months. You know, what can you tell them? Can you tell them where you're going? Can you give them a web address or a cell phone number? And that stuff can and should be thought of when you're drafting your contracts on the front end.
Right. That is a great, great point, because, and it's a particular issue with surgeons, orthopedic surgeons and other types of surgeons, because you typically, you know, during your notice period, don't necessarily want to do a surgery when you're not going to be following up care. But this gets into another area of the law having to do with patient abandonment. And the general, court perspective on this has been, if you're in a practice with 20 surgeons and the patient is going to get follow up with another surgeon or easily scheduled with another surgeon, then we don't really need to worry. And in fact, the practice does enforce, we control the message. We don't have to tell them where you're going. They're not going to be abandoned. But if you're the only one in a practice, then we do kind of get into that situation. So it is a case by case. And it's an area we work with, you know, a lot that creates a lot of, conflict for departing physician. We could go into this at length, but that is a really good point that you made.
Thanks. Yeah, it's very different for a 3-person practice versus a 30-person practice. A lot of that stuff sort of plays differently and should be contracted for differently.
Right. I generally just tell my clients, you know, let's work out a script with the employer, but you telling your patient before you've spoken to the employer where you're going, when you're leaving, and how to reach you could be viewed as solicitation. So you really don't want to go there, you know, on your own without having a conversation with the employer first.
Right. And I think it's tempting for non-lawyers to say, well, if it's just a conversation, I'm going to get away with it. I didn't write anything down. But, you know, 6 months later, when 75 patients are at the new practice, you know, you don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out what happened.
Right, exactly. All right, so one last thing I want to cover, and then you'll have to come back because we could talk about this endlessly, is, how do we help make non-competes more enforceable? And, you know, we're sitting here in Illinois, and there's been some case law over the past couple of years that has made it pretty clear that the court is looking for some consideration, something of value that the employer has given the employee. Examples might be some kind of cash payment when they start working, like a bonus, or something of value, maybe an agreement not to let them go without cause. We even have kind of a statutory proposal that's out there right now that might codify some of this. And I know other states as well, the concept of consideration is a contract concept. I still think, though, that a lot of people believe just the offer of employment or continuation of employment is going to be enough. You know, what is your recommendation? What should employers be doing? Is it enough to offer the job anymore?
So let me make a general statement, and then I'll offer some specifics. The general statement for employers, I would say, is non-compete. It is more important to write it to your business needs than it is to maximize your leverage. You may be in a position where, because of who you are, and maybe it's a young physician just starting without a lot of reputational credibility or something like that, you may be able to force a giant, horrible, overbearing non-compete on this person and have them sign it. Just because you can doesn't mean that you should. And so the tailoring, I think, starts with the consideration. And Illinois courts have been very, you know, critical of this idea that if by your grace, you employ them, and therefore there's been consideration for the non-compete. That only works in Illinois if the person is with you for 2 years or more. And that's been a legal rule here. And it's, I believe, I'm overgeneralizing a little bit, it's about to become part of statutory law as well. What is far more defensible, protectable, and enforceable is some sort of cash consideration. So whether you call it a non-compete bonus or a signing bonus, if you remember, if there's any lawyers listening, you remember the peppercorn lecture from law school on consideration. It doesn't have to be $100,000. It may not even have to be $10,000, but it's got to be something. So I would encourage you to think about your legal fees for the last time you litigated a non-compete and consider that some small fraction of those applied as a non-compete bonus to a new employee will be worth it. And same thing as we've talked all along, after you've done that, think about what kind of duration do I really need? If all of my patients are seen within a year, then why do I need a 2-year non-compete? If, again, as we talked about earlier, if you're just concerned about the competing hospital, then maybe it's where they go, not how far away they go. And really think about what you need from a business perspective, not what you can force on them because you've got leverage in the negotiation.
Great. I think that's really helpful. And, you know, for my employers that I work with and employees, I mean, I think for me, we always spend time thinking about our exit strategy. How do I get out of this contract and what are the consequences? And the non-compete, non-solicitation is a big consequence. If you can't live with it, you should not be signing that contract. And if you do sign the contract, you need to make sure that you're going to abide by it. And that is generally the advice I provide. I don't think people signing it and thinking, oh, it's not enforceable, or, you know, I heard my friend got out of it, or my mentor told me they aren't really enforceable anyways. I think that's like a big misunderstanding of how enforceable non-competes can be. And unless you want to hire, you know, Adam to kind of help you through the process,
I'm here if people need me, but from the employee perspective, what the dynamic a lot of times is, especially if it's for a bigger institution, is you are going to get a form contract. You are going to get something that is not tailored either to the current practice, which obviously is constantly changing, or to you, you know, who you are and where you are in your career. And so, yes, it's true that these employers are not likely to negotiate, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. And that doesn't mean you can't say, hey, I don't think this was written for me. Here's my changes and here's why they make sense for both of us. So again, on the employee side, it's not about maximizing leverage. It's about what can I pare back from something that may be overbroad that, as you say, that I can live with. Right. And so I do think there is room on the employee side to do more than take or leave on the front end.
Right. Well, you know, it's always worth a shot, right? You know, sometimes you get lucky and you can get changes, sometimes you can't. And so I think it's just important to understand what you've agreed to. Yes. So there's no surprises. The worst is not realizing what you agreed to. So any final thoughts on this topic?
None other than that, you know, this is, you know, stay tuned because this is a very high volume litigation area. There are lots of new cases. There's lots of work in state legislatures. And so I would look forward to coming back and this is how we see things now. And 6 months from now, there may be 4 more things we've got to talk about because stuff has changed. So consider this a snapshot, not something that's going to be etched in stone for a long time.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Adam. And thank you all for coming on the HealthLaw Hotspot, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Erica. Bye.
The Retzel HealthLaw Hotspot is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Retzel HealthLaw Hotspot does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Retzel HealthLaw Hotspot should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.